You're listening to the College is Worth It podcast. Learn from leaders who are transforming higher education to ensure that a college degree will pay off for this generation and the next by exploring innovations in education with us in each episode. And now your host, V. Nguyen.
Hello, everyone. This is V. Nguyen, and you're listening to the College is Worth It podcast. I'm really excited to be speaking with Carol Stevens today, who has extensive experience in the education space, from his role as an associate dean at Yale Law School to starting up K-12 charter schools, and now his current role as an interim president of Rhodes College. Carol is able to inform us how his diverse array of experiences in the education space has assisted him in this particularly challenging time for college presidents due to the pandemic. Specifically, he focuses on how a residential liberal arts college like Rhodes College, who values their in-person tight-knit community, was able to create this virtual community. And generally, Carol will share his valuable insights on general trends in the education space, for example, how to increase access. So let's get started. It is with extreme pleasure that I introduce Carol Stevens. Hi, Carol.
Hi, V. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm great. It's terrific to see you again.
Yeah, it's always great speaking to you. And I'm very excited, of course, to speak with you specifically about the long and impressive career you've had in higher education that I cannot wait to learn more about. Before that, of course, you're at Rhodes College right now. So can I ask you, how's your interim presidency at Rhodes College going?
Well, it's a challenging time to be a college president at any and every institution. I'm just back from a meeting of presidents of Presbyterian colleges. That's Rhodes historical roots, and we spent 3 days comparing perspectives. There are a lot of long-serving presidents in that group, and an extraordinary group, and we all agreed on two things. I think one is that this is perhaps the most challenging period, but also the most interesting period in which to be a college president. And the other thing was that it has helped those of us with long years of experience. We have had the opportunity to put all of that experience into practice and stretch and grow some more, which is for all of the energy depletion that presidents are experiencing these days, there is a sense of fulfillment and fresh energy that's coming as we anticipate what our opportunities comprise for this next period of service to the country and the world.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. Could you expand a little bit more? You called it challenging and interesting. So what is exactly challenging about this time period you've experienced as interim president?
Well, of course, we've had to go through institutionally everything that the nation and the world has had to go through in the public health crisis that we've experienced on a rolling basis. First, increasing and then subsiding and then changing character. So remaining healthy and whole as an institution, both in the people of the institution and in the finances and physical infrastructure of the institution during this period has been a really without precedent. We've had to improvise in ways we never have had to before, but we've had to become develop an expertise in pivoting from one thing to the next and doing it well in real time so that our students don't miss out on their once in a lifetime opportunity to have a meaningful developmental residential, in our case, residential liberal arts college experience. And I shared with my fellow presidents that I was happily astonished when the most recent issue of the Rhodes College magazine was given to me. And I realized it ran to 100 pages of student and faculty and alumni accomplishment, and said, from all of that activity and impact one would have never known there was a pandemic at the same time. So I want to believe that we're developing new skills and have acquired new, let's call it execution knowledge in how we deliver educational services that really are going to redound to the benefit of coming generations of law students. I prefer to think we, for whatever ground we may have lost, we've gained rather a lot in delivering on our core mission and just having come through it fashions a kind of resilience that we didn't know we had and wondered if we could acquire, but I think we have.
That's great to hear. And of course, throughout time, society and people are constantly questioning, is college still worth it? And a lot of our listeners are wondering that as well. And so you mentioned that Rhodes was able to maintain this and still, you know, create positive student outcomes. And so I was wondering, especially specifically with a residential liberal arts college like Rhodes College, how did Rhodes College and you work to maintain the value proposition of a college education during these unprecedented times?
Well, we had to pay a lot of attention to our human capital. And attend to carefully to the learning outcomes that we knew from experience that our students were in need of, and then be improvisational as to how those outcomes could be achieved. How can we alter the inputs from the traditional such that through cyberspace, that same knowledge could be imparted and skills developed in an environment of virtual community, sufficient to kind of hold us together until we could be together, because in residential liberal arts experience, a lot depends on serendipitous learning. The debates and arguments that you have at night in the dorm room with your friends who are taking different subjects than you, and you asking them what they've been up to all day and learning from that, and sharing with them what you were struggling with and getting their perspective on it. There's no substitute for that, really. So we had to accommodate ourselves as kind of brokers of knowledge and expertise in ways that we didn't. And a lot of individual tutorials broke out as a result of that. Students helping one another and faculty helping students on an individualized basis. So it, for all of its, it was confusing in the beginning. It was messy in the middle, but in the end, it has turned out all right. And I want to believe, as a lifelong educator, that our students, higher education as compared to primary or secondary education, higher education really depends a lot on individualized learning and on individual intellectual motivation, interest, curiosity, and so forth. And I am prepared to believe that this cohort of students who've come through colleges like Rhodes have gotten even better at that to their benefit. Lifelong, they're going to be themselves better able to pivot as their own interests change and their priorities develop, and as economic and other circumstances change. It seems to be the case that we can expect rather a lot of volatility in political and economic terms in the period ahead. And I don't know, I'm very optimistic about this cohort of young people being adept at and prepared for dealing with such conditions, because after all, that's how they've been developed as college students.
That's great to hear. Well, I'll take that as a compliment to myself I'm someone who came from a small liberal arts college and also graduated virtually. I can definitely relate to the struggles of being a virtual community, but sort of the kind of the character development that comes to that time, the genuine love of academics that you need to foster when you're sitting alone in your room and studying. And so you talk a lot about creativity in higher education and kind of fostering this virtual community we're talking about. I'm curious if you think the tools that you use during this time will continue to be used as innovation in higher education in the residential liberal arts community, or do you think that the importance of being together physically still remain?
Yes to all of that. I'm fortunate to have been the product of professionally of four institutions that prized and prioritized experiential learning or problem-based learning. So the law school is that, University of Kentucky Law School. The Yale Law School was especially strong at that. Claremont McKenna College, among undergraduate institutions, is surpassingly good at that kind of experiential learning outlet for students and faculty working together. And it turns out Rhodes College is very similar to Claremont McKenna in that regard. So I come from and have been shaped by educational organizations where that's kind of baked in. And I think we've only at Rhodes gotten better at it and become exemplars of it, an institution that our peers look to for advice and guidance and examples. So yeah, I think we have not only kept the faith, but promoted it well with this cohort of students, and we are seeing that it travels well with other institutions that are doing likewise. So I think we higher education will be coming out of this with a new appreciation for efficiency and effectiveness of the learning process. And it wouldn't surprise me if in a decade and maybe less time than that, more and more of our students will be able to complete the course of study in entirely satisfactorily in 3 years rather than 4 years, if that is their preference. In fact, a growing number of students here at Rhodes, as was the case at Claremont McKenna, are using their fourth year or even adding on a fifth year simply to have a broader experience to, in some cases, in substitute for a master's program. So making the BA, getting all the value that a baccalaureate level degree can and should prefer, and having the advantage of a graduate level experience too in the work, the research work that they do with their faculty members and in their upper level course selection at both of my recent institutions, Claremont McKenna and Rhodes College. The comment I hear most from people who did go on to graduate school, graduates of the institution, did go into graduate study, the most often heard comment was graduate school was a snap given how well my undergraduate experience prepared me. Aha, there's a learning. We should own that fully for the undergraduate experience so as to make the opportunity cost of the four-year experience and the out-of-pocket cost for that period of time really produce maximum value economically and in terms of career satisfaction for our graduates. That's within our reach.
Yeah, I cannot agree more. I think innovation definitely increases the value of a college education. And I like what you mentioned about how flexible higher education institutions have been throughout this past year or two. I think a lot of people think of higher ed in general as a sort of traditional and slow-moving body. However, these past couple of years have only shown the exact opposite. And so you mentioned a little bit in your past answer, my alma mater, Claremont McKenna College. And so I just was wondering if you could kind of branch off about your long distinguished career in higher education. You've served in a lot of different capacities. And so could you tell our listeners a little bit more about your professional background and experiences in Claremont McKenna, Yale Law School?
Well, I'm happy to do it. I actually, as an undergraduate at a little liberal arts college in Kentucky, which had, which was quite old, and had produced throughout its history, a long line of educational leaders, including college presidents. A career in higher education administration appealed to me even as an undergraduate. So that's the image I began to form for myself and the goal I began to create, only wondering what the right path would be for me developmentally in terms of postgraduate experience. The great thing about a liberal arts education is it prepares you for so many things in real time. So for me, that right developmental path ended up being law school, because I observed and was counseled that was in the very early 1970s, that what was described as the higher education institutions of the future, what was then the future, would be increasingly large, complicated, regulated, and have new resource opportunities and challenges. And so the kind of knowledge and skills one would develop in law school would be very useful for a leader of higher education institutions to have. Already by that time, law-trained people were beginning to be hired as college presidents. Not that many. There hadn't been much of a tradition, but it was beginning to happen. And so that's the career I imagined for myself. And my own law school, 6 months after I graduated, recruited me back into the administration to help them develop new programs of outreach and new academic program and new services in the way of career formation and career services, which fields were really badly underdeveloped in all law schools as of that time. And we had some really good results from the things I was involved in, which helped my old school rise dramatically in the rankings, and which gave me exposure into a national the national scene in higher education, which in due course, after 11 years, resulted in other law schools coming to me to recruit me, including the Yale Law School, which I was delighted to hear from, because even there, it turned out there was a lot of work to be done. It was work that I'd had experience and something of a track record in doing at the University of Kentucky that they believed, and I also assumed, was transferable into an institution of a very different kind. And it was there that I was privileged to be an associate dean for what turned out to be 18 years, which by Yale standards is almost an unprecedented length of time. But we got a lot of accomplished in the law school itself, and in elevating the law school's profile and moving clearly into the very front rank in terms of rankings and redeveloping entirely our physical campus and much of our academic program, and then contributing to our community of New Haven in ways that helped it and its economy be transformed. You were a student at Claremont McKenna College, where undergraduates were actually involved in projects of the very same kind, contributing to the Inland Empire, throughout the Inland Empire of California and beyond. We could spend the whole program talking about what those programs comprise, but you get the picture. And that's what the Yale Law School was about in New Haven. Led to an opportunity to come out into primary and secondary education, where I had never before worked together with my students. And through their leadership, I was just initially their faculty sponsor. We ended up creating a charter school in 1999 called Amistad Academy, based on best practices that we had gleaned from around the country and actually up into Canada as well, best practices from schools that were serving high needs kids that ensured that they graduated from high school ready for success in the next phase of their lives, but with a big emphasis on college going. With a population for whom, for the most part, they would be first generation students. And that success, we were invited to take to scale, and which has since become Achievement First, of which I was the founding chairman, which now operates 44 schools, I think it is, in New York City, in across Connecticut, and in Providence, Rhode Island, a mature organization that has by now educated tens of thousands of inner city kids, kids in poverty, kids of color, who've gone on to amazing, you know, successes in the finest colleges in the land, and on into the best medical schools and law schools and business schools and PhD programs, and many of them coming back into their own community or going into communities similar to those that they grew up in, and living lives of leadership and service. And that led to the opportunity through the Stupski Foundation to take those learnings to scale in urban school districts across the country. So the next assignment meant growing and stretching even more, and adapting that which was learned in the context of individual schools, and systematizing it, and building durable policies and structures and resourcing mechanisms that ensured that once progress was made in improving student outcomes, that could be sustained over time. And several Stupski school districts and school districts served by Stupski's successor organization, Cambridge Education, an offshoot of Cambridge University in England, of which I was the American head, magnified the impact of the Stupski Foundation in primary and secondary education. So, and some of that led to work I was invited to do overseas, particularly in Taiwan. So it's been a great journey of learning, and I would like to thank a contribution, but it's involved coming in and out of higher education all along. My sojourn at Claremont McKenna was designed as an interim assignment. I'd been in business since the 1990s. I've been an advisor to early stage technology companies of one kind or another. And so I took a pause from that from 2014 to 2019 to join the team at Claremont McKenna, which then led to, in its own way, me being asked to be a trustee at Rhodes College. Rhodes, like most college boards wish to have a board member who's experienced in higher education leadership, just to provide that kind of perspective to the board, which is typically made up of people from business and the professions, but not themselves experienced in higher education. And then when we lost our president here at Rhodes to a big job in Washington, the Rhodes board turned to me to say, you know, this interim thing that you do, could you do that for us? And I was honored and thought it would be, of course it was scary. I'd been a trustee of an undergraduate college and I had been a senior vice president at Claremont McKenna, but coming right into the hot seat was felt right. And it's just been warm and comforting, not so hot after all, the seat.
So yeah, now you're the interim president at Rhodes College. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, well, clearly you've had a long, admirable, and very, very impressed career in higher education. What most interests me is how diverse your career has been, you know, from every level of education you've experienced. So I'm so curious, what would your takes be on what is currently the biggest challenge in the education space today, or even just more specifically, the higher education space?
Well, affordability and accessibility rank right up there at the top, and in ensuring completion of the degree program followed close behind. We know from ample evidence that every year of post-secondary attainment improves life outcomes in terms of personal satisfaction and personal circumstances, economic and otherwise. And we know also from ample evidence that completing the degree program you began has a compounding effect for people and for society. The costs have risen over time to an extent now where the cumulative outlay and the opportunity cost is really considerable and has to be managed, thought about, and managed. Institutions everywhere are doing everything they can to buffer that through their own funds and funds they're able to raise. And thank goodness, philanthropists still very much, and I would say to a growing extent, are prepared to invest in higher education infrastructure because they understand the value return to society of students attending and completing a college degree. Still, there is this gap. So many students have to cover that through borrowing. That becomes worrisome to students and families and results too often in students not following their heart's desire, but going where they feel they can and should in order to lessen the burden on their parents and on themselves. And that's not right. You know, we need to do everything we can to ensure that students attend their first choice institution, an institution that inspires them and excites them and will motivate them and support them in the kind of life they want to develop for themselves. Because every time in life you settle for something that is not really what you should be doing, something is lost to the individual and to society. And the evidence I have about that is mostly qualitative, but there's rather than quantitative, but there's a lot of it. When parents and students and institutions and communities have I have said to their young people, yes, go for it. We support you. We encourage you. Then wonderful things happen. But when students feel like they have to settle, it can be the stuff of discouragement and dissatisfaction and sometimes failure to thrive in the organization. My long work with students and prospective students teaches me that students instinctively know, prospective students instinctively know which college is right for them. They can feel it when they walk on campus. They size it up. It's a product of a complex intake of tangibles and intangibles. But when they know, it's the right thing for them to do. So it's up to us, as the rest of society, to be sure those pathways are open. I think about my kids from achievement first schools. We worry about what is called in the literature the undermatching problem. These are kids who have had the experience of success in their academic programs in primary and secondary school, and they're ready. They've been challenged. They've risen to the challenge in an environment of high expectations and high support, and they deserve to go on into an environment where that also will be the case. And yet, if they come, as most of them do, from families below the poverty line, you know, the local, state, or community college might look like the only place they literally can go. And they go there and they're encountering material they might have dealt with as a seventh grader. That literally happened to me. I'm thinking of one student who reported that back in our early days, which caused me to realize early on we needed to invest in the post-secondary success of our students in terms of helping them get placed in the colleges that they deserved and helping ensure that the colleges would provide the enabling support for that to happen. That needs to happen for every college-bound student in the country.
Yes, I cannot agree more, especially from my personal experience as a first-generation student. I sought out institutions that had good programs that could support me. And I think a lot of disadvantaged communities need higher education institutions that can support them. And so that kind of goes along to what you're talking about. There's more to college, a college decision. There's a feeling when you know an institution will be able to support your very specific identity. And so it is sad to think that high costs are affecting, especially disadvantaged communities who, you know, need specific types of institutions that can support them through their hardships and such. So thank you so much for that answer. I was wondering, since you work with so many different types of institutions, what have institutions in the past done, or institutions that you've worked with in the past done, to address either access or affordability concerns?
Well, it's taken different forms at different phases of my career. In the early days, we really had the need to open up new pathways for students like yourself. Who didn't come from, you know, families where higher education was a known and familiar quantity, and we needed to begin to look more like the country itself was looking in the composition of our student body. So ethnically, demographically, linguistically, and so forth. So making sure we were places of belonging and welcoming to new cohorts of students. For me, as a law student, it sounds like it's almost unbelievable to think of it now, when law schools are typically, well, in many cases, 55 or 60% women. But when I entered in 1973, my class was 35% women, and it was by far the largest percentage of women ever to enroll in legal education. The year before, I think there had been 7 women in a class of about 150. So not enough even to calculate a percentage around. And yet overnight, because the school had really opened its eyes and opened its doors and been solicitous of new talent, women students responded. And to us, you know, it was as if it had been ever thus. We had not known anything different because this was our class. And the it was a delight to everybody when the first year grades were tabulated that the number one person in our class was a woman, and she was a classmate of mine from my little college. So, and they were brave and courageous. And when we graduated, their job getting rate and what was equal to the man was just terrific. It was as if it had ever been thus. But they proved the proposition that, of course, women could do as well or better than the man in a profession that largely had just, if not shut women out, at least ignored women as prospects for the profession. So all of the learned professions were undergoing that kind of transition, and then doing the same with communities of color to both include and support and recruit and into a culture of belonging and being a part of that and being, I'd like to think, something of an agent of that as I became an administrator has really been the most fulfilling part of my career.
Wow, that is such a fun anecdote, especially due to current day context. We're seeing, of course, a Supreme Court nominee who is a female person of color from a similar institution that you came from, or your competitor, I guess, Harvard Law, which is funny. Yeah, thank you so much for that. Well, I guess so, we're running out of time. So lastly, I'm just curious what is next for you after your interim presidency at Rhodes College? Because of course, it implies that it will come to an end eventually.
Well, yeah, maybe. There is some new data out that indicates that the most productive period in a person's professional life is in the period between age 60 and age 80. I'm 72, soon to be 73. And I'm prepared to believe that there may be something to that. And for this reason, the body of knowledge and experience that one gains over a long career, it's a long book with many chapters, is useful in times of turmoil and change and uncertainty and instability because we may not have seen this particular matter before, but something similar which suggests a path forward. It's as I think I said at the outset, it's been really fulfilling to have to bring all that to bear and have it to bring to bear and to see the response and the impact of that experience. And so we'll see what the future holds. I have a couple of projects that I have in mind. I have something of a background in the performing arts. I actually ran one of the major producing theaters in the country, the Schubert Theater in New Haven, in the capacity as board chair. And I live in a community in Northern California that is populated by a lot of performing artists, musicians, and actors, and playwrights, and writers. And I've been invited in that community to help actually create some new theatrical content. And that excites me because it will be a play for children that focuses on the environment as a learning opportunity and an opportunity to express their theatrical interests and talents. And some other things are coming along. Ideas are creeping in my head, but my whole I think it is the case that I've never in my career had to apply for any of the jobs that I've actually had, that people who know me and with all my eccentricities and know something of my track record have come to me to say, what about this? And I kind of know it when I see it. So I guess I expect that will continue as long as I have something to contribute. We'll see. Stay tuned.
Well, that makes sense because you've lived a very interesting, successful life. So I could definitely see how that has happened. And I'm excited to hear more about your theatrics is it Nicasio, California? Is it Northern California?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I look forward to continuing our relationship and working together on our favorite project, providing loan repayment assistance support to America's college students.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today. You brought so much wonderful information. So is there anything else you'd like to add as we end this podcast episode?
Oh, I don't think so, except to encourage the students and aspiring students in our audience to, to aim high, to think about what's right for them, and to pursue your calling, and make your calling your career. Because when you do, we call it work because it requires effort, but it can bring such joy to you, and at the same time, benefits and fulfillment to others. And it's really what I think we're put on this earth to do.
Thank you so much for that wonderful piece of advice. And thank you again. It was so nice speaking to you, Carol.
Thank you for the opportunity and privilege. Great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is brought to you by Ardeo Education Solutions. Ardeo Education Solutions provides loan repayment assistance programs, known as LRAPs, to increase access and enrollment at higher ed institutions. Ardeo's LRAPs help graduates with modest incomes repay their federal student, Parent Plus, and private alternative loans. The powerful promise they provide gives students the confidence they need to enroll. To learn more about Ardeo, visit us on the web at ardeo.org.